WBOI Presents In Session is a series where we'll hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear from Chris Erickson from Purdue Fort Wayne on the topic of history. Thank you for listening. Welcome to WBOI Presents. I'm Ben Clemmer. It's been 400 years since African slaves were first brought to the United States. In the centuries that followed, racism in the U.S. has taken many forms: Jim Crow laws, segregated schools, and mass incarceration. Since the end of the Civil War, racism in America has been associated with one group that formed after the war ended, the Ku Klux Klan. The KKK is still active, and with white supremacy at the forefront of conversations about gun violence and immigration today, understanding the Klan's past brings another perspective to our present. My guest instructor is an associate professor of history at Purdue University Fort Wayne. She's also working on a book entitled Fraternity on the Frontier: The Ku Klux Klan in Montana During the 1920s. She's also published two articles on the Klan. Chris Erickson, welcome to WBOI Presents.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start at the 100 level. What are some of the main things to know about the history of the KKK, and how strong are the roots of the Klan in Indiana?
All right, there's a long history of the Klan in this country. As you mentioned, the first Klan was formed during Reconstruction, right after the Civil War. It was a Southern organization which targeted specifically the 4 million freed slaves. The second Klan is the one we generally think of when we think of the Klan in the United States. It targeted blacks, Catholics. In fact, the second Klan was viciously anti-Catholic, as the Grand Dragon of Oregon said, quote, "The only good Catholic is a dead one." It targeted Jews. It targeted bootleggers. You know, anybody who didn't quite fit into their vision of who an American was. And the realm of Indiana was one of the most powerful realms. It was led by Grand Dragon D.C. Stevenson, who had a history of sexual assault and heavy drinking. Please note that the Klan stood for prohibition as well as honoring white womanhood, and so the Grand Dragon violated those aspects of the Klan in the worst way possible. He kidnapped and raped his secretary. He not only raped her, got her drunk, he chewed her, he bit her. There were bite marks all over her body. His secretary was so distraught that she took poison and killed herself, but not before making a deathbed statement naming Stevenson as her attacker. She said, "I'll have the law on you." And he replied, "I am the law in Indiana." Stevenson was eventually convicted of second-degree murder and sent to prison. So Indiana had a very strong Klan. There were over 350,000 people who joined. Fort Wayne was a little smaller in that kind of scale. It had around 5,000 members. In fact, there's an interesting newspaper article from the New York Times in late 1923 declaring that 100,000 Klansmen were going to be marching in Fort Wayne. I'm not sure the 100,000 really happened. It was probably a great exaggeration. But Fort Wayne did not have as strong a presence in the Klan community as especially southern Indiana or Indianapolis. There was a Catholic mayor here. He wasn't too impressed, and he pretty much ignored the Klan. The second Klan, this great invisible empire and had realms all over the country, faded by the late 1920s and early 30s for a number of reasons. The coming of the Great Depression, the downfall of D.C. Stevenson, that cannot be over-exaggerated. The Klan was also a very corrupt organization at the top. Revelations about that were coming through. And there are some other reasons as well. That second Klan faded to its original confines in the Deep South. The Klan rode again in the coming of the Civil Rights Movement. And so 1950s, 1960s, it wasn't one big invisible empire at that time. It was more broken up. There were state organizations, local organizations. Moreover, there were many other white supremacist groups during that civil rights era. The Klan was the most overtly violent and racist, but thousands of citizens joined organizations like the Citizens Councils that kind of cemented a kind of quasi-respectable facade on the resistance movement.
This is WBOI Presents In Session. Our guest instructor is Chris Erickson, and this episode is History, Lesson 2. Let's talk about some of the imagery a lot of people associate with the Klan. Where did the white or sometimes purple hoods come from? I mean, whether it's being reproduced for a period piece or even lampooned in Blazing Saddles, you see the hood and you know that's a Klansman. This might also be a good time to address the terminology like wizard, cyclops, and dragon, because to a layperson, it sounds a little unusual.
So the very distinctive outfits of the Klan, the white hoods and robes, the purple hood and robe was reserved just for the imperial wizard. Everybody else wore white. The burning cross, right, also a symbol of the Klan. This was all the dream child of imperial wizard William Joseph Simmons, who resurrected the Klan from the graveyard of Southern Reconstruction in 1915. And I think one of the reasons he's creating these kinds of outfits is that he wants to inspire fear, kind of hearkening back to that first Klan. He wants to inspire mystery, and he doesn't want people to be identified. As for the structure of the rest of the Klan, that also belongs to Imperial Wizard Simmons. Simmons wanted to create a secret fraternity, and he belonged to many secret fraternities, and this would be modeled after that first Klan. So he created a constitution, many pages, which outlined in very hierarchical form the structure of the Klan. So at the top is the imperial wizard and all of his officers. Each state was a realm. There were some territories as well. There was a Klan in the Panama Canal Zone, the Pacific Klan, Alaska even had a Klan. And the head of each realm was a Grand Dragon appointed by the Imperial Wizard. And the Grand Dragon, along with his officers, a Kleegrap, a Clud, a Clad, a Nighthawk, and so forth, and they ruled the realm. At the local level was the Exalted Cyclops. And he also had his Kleegrap, Clud, Clad, and Nighthawk just at the local level. And they had very strict membership rules. Only white native-born Protestants could join. So what's useful to remember is that the Klan wasn't the only nativist organization in town. Many other secret fraternities had these kinds of restrictions. Only whites could join. Only Protestants could join. And so secret fraternities were much more important in our culture in the 19th century and into the 20th. It is something that we don't really think of too much in these days, but it was an important rite of passage. Many young men were expected to follow their fathers into the secret fraternities, into the Masonic orders, the International Order of Odd Fellows, the Woodmen, the Knights of Pythias, and many, many others. And so the Klan, like these other kinds of secret fraternities, had degrees, they had rituals, they had initiation rites, they had special rites for funeral services, they had specific diagrams that outlined what the clavern should look like and where each Klansman should stand. They had the cross, they had the Bible open to Romans 12, which depicted a good Protestant life. So there's lots of, you were talking about symbolism earlier, there's a lot of symbolism within the Klan of the 1920s.
So who are some of the key players in the Klan's history? Who are some that maybe perhaps fly under the radar in a sense? I guess let's pull off the hoods.
This is a little more difficult to get at because the Klan didn't publish their membership lists, and that's why it's very difficult to get an accurate count on just who joined, for how long, how many joined. We know that roughly 3 to 4 million people joined the Klan in the 1920s. Notably, very ordinary people joined the Klan for a variety of different reasons. One point of note for Indiana, as once Hiram Wesley Evans retired from his position of Imperial Wizard of the 1930s, there is a palace coup in the early 1920s where Evans took away the throne from Simmons, a veterinarian from Terre Haute became the Imperial Wizard. Many of these Klansmen across the country were often leading members of the community, and in some states and communities, very powerful politically. In one small town that I was looking at, a small town of about 2,000 people in Montana, and I was fortunate enough to get a hold of the membership list held at the Montana Historical Society in Helena, I found that the chief of police, all of the major county offices, the county clerk, recorder, treasurer, attorney, surveyor, assessor, commissioner, and at least 5 managers of local businesses, at least 1 minister, a dentist, an editor of the local newspaper, the postmaster, all these guys joined the Klan. And this is a very small town. That's just one example. In the state of Arkansas, There were so many Klansmen running for state offices that the realm even held its own primaries to choose which knight to support in the Democratic primaries. The South was kind of, at that time, was a one-party region. Oklahoma, Kansas, Kentucky. Nationally, if you look at any of the newspapers of the time, the Klan was front page news during the 1924 election. All of the major newspapers, at least during the Democratic National Convention, talked about the Klan. This was front page news. And if your listeners are interested in learning more about the second Klan of the 1920s, I would highly recommend Thomas Pegram's book, 100% American, published in 2011.
You mentioned a resurgence that began in the mid-19-teens and continued into the 20s. Historically, when has the Klan been strongest and when has it been weakest as well? What are some of the reasons for fluctuation over time?
The first Klan of Reconstruction was a night riding terrorist organization. It was formed as a way for white Southerners to do a couple of things, to exert political control over the black community, to terrorize blacks into submission, and, number two, to remove the Republican Party from political power. It was very strong in the late 1860s, early 1870s, until Congress passed anti-Klan legislation. The second Klan emerged because of an unease of white Protestant America after World War I. There was a fear of different cultures, a fear of the so-called, quote-unquote, invasion of immigrants. Something like 23 to 24 million immigrants come over to this country between the 1880s and World War I. Immigration really starts to pick up again after the war. Anti-Catholicism is still a very big issue, and the Klan promised to save America from the clutches of the Pope. And so there were a lot of motivations for people to join this second Klan in the 1920s. Now, there was no third Klan to speak of. Again, it was fractured by the time we get to the Civil Rights Movement. And importantly to note, there are many other white supremacist groups that are forming in the 1950s, 60s, and beyond. But clearly, the citizens' councils and the Klan felt threatened from the changes that the Civil Rights Movement was demanding, especially after Brown v. Board of Education decision in 1954. And I think that's what's at the root of these kinds of groups. There's a fear of change, a fear that a growing multicultural, pluralistic society somehow threatens their existence.
There has been an uptick in recent years in instances of domestic terrorism, mass shootings. Many have made connections between the recent violence and white supremacy. Have we seen an uptick in membership in white supremacist groups in recent years, if not the KKK itself?
We can kind of think of the rise of the right as this huge kind of racist family tree. There are a lot of interconnections between members of the Klan, members of various white supremacist groups. For instance, former head of the Klan in California in the 1970s created a white supremacist organization called WAR, White Aryan Resistance. I take it back to the 1970s, late 1970s, 80s, and 90s, with the emergence of Aryan Nations, one of the most powerful white supremacist groups in the country at the time, and its militant arm called the Order. And I mention the Order because, and we get back to that family tree, the guy who created the Order is a guy named Bob Matthews. He was a coordinator for the National Alliance in the Pacific Northwest. And the National Alliance, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, was the most dangerous and organized neo-Nazi group of the time. This is a group that called for the total annihilation of Jews, the total genocide of Jews, and anybody else who wasn't white. And so Bob Matthews was part of this Order, kind of this military arm of Aryan Nations, which went on a series of very violent armed robberies and ended up murdering a Jewish radio host in Denver in 1984. At the end of that year, there was a big shootout on Whidbey Island, Washington, with the FBI. Now, the men who died in that shootout, including Bob Matthews, are still considered heroes of the racist right. So one of the points I want to make here is that while the Klan is still active in Indiana, we have two active Klans according to the 2018 research done by SPLC. The Klan is just part of the action. Many other groups are forming with these similar kinds of ideologies.
One more thought before we end our time here. Earlier, you mentioned the Klan's response to Brown versus Board of Education and the civil rights movement. In a previous in-session conversation in season one, I spoke about media literacy with Kristen Miller from USF, and we talked about how the internet gives us access to everything, but then also everything can have access to us. And that access can greatly increase the reach and influence of white supremacist groups, and it can also distort the real impact that they have. Do you think we are likely to see their influence grow, or is fighting a battle against changing demographics a battle that they're going to ultimately lose, and what we're experiencing now is just them not going quietly?
Unless Facebook and other kinds of social media really starts to clamp down on hate groups and hate speech, I don't see this going away anytime soon. I mean, one of the things that I've seen is that, and all of us have seen, is that people start to live in their own bubbles. Well, the racist right also lives in their own bubble. They have their own websites. They have their own media. For example, and it now goes under a different name, but one of the primary websites for the racist right was a website called Stormfront. It not only had news or misinformation about current events, but there was information about rock concerts. There was a dating site on Stormfront, right, where you could just hook up with people who thought like you. There's a whole social setup. And I think that is going to be difficult to crack in this age of social media.
Chris Erickson, thank you so much for being a part of Season 2 of WBOI Presents In Session. Thank you for sharing your knowledge and your research with our listeners.
Thank you for inviting me to the program.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session. You can find more episodes of WBOI Presents In Session at WBOI.org. And while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team and stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Our sound effects are by John Dawkins. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. Thank you for listening.